Okay, let's get started here. So, how was the test? Boring? Horrible. Okay. Well, we'll see. I haven't graded anything, so I will see how people have done. It was on the longer side, but there was one extra question. I don't know if you noticed that the points added to 110, not 100. And I just thought I'll put an extra question, so if you can get more than 100 and boost your overall standing in the course. But so can everyone else. So okay. So let me grade it and we'll see how people did. So just to remind you where we are, we have about maybe 8 or 9 more lectures to go. Two assignments are done. There is one more coming. Okay, that's the last programming assignment. And there is either one or two homeworks to go. I think you have done two homeworks, right? So there are two more homeworks and one assignment remaining. So I'll try to hand the assignment out earlier, so you get more time. I mean, it's the usual 2-week assignment, but everything sort of adds up towards the end of the semester. You have a lot on your plate, so you can give it out early if you want. Okay. But I do need to finish a little bit of the material before I hand it out. So maybe next week I can hand that out. So let's continue where we left off last time. There were a few slides on fault tolerance that I didn't finish. So I'm going to finish that and then start a new chapter, which is going to be on security. Okay. So if you recall all of the discussion we were having last time, we looked at the notion of Byzantine fault tolerance, where any process can be faulty. And by faults here, we don't mean that it can just fail, but it can continue to function but produce arbitrary results. Okay. So we looked at the Byzantine general problem and the problem of how many replicas does it take to detect who is faulty and to agree on what the result should be. Okay. So with all of that background in mind, let me now talk about the other aspect of fault tolerance, which is recovery. So how do you go about recovering from failures? Okay, so here we are now back to crash fault tolerance, although some of these techniques would apply even to Byzantine fault tolerance. Okay, So recovery is the set of operations that must be performed after a failure to recover to a correct state. Okay, now I'll talk about techniques like checkpointing, but just to understand some of the state of the art, if there is a failure or there is a crash of some sort, what usually happens is you may have to reinstall the application, get its data from a tape backup, restore it, and then restart the application. Okay, so that's a manual process. It takes a long time and there is application downtime while this recovery is in progress. Okay. Now there are other forms of recovery. One we'll talk about is basically checkpointing. So we mentioned this checkpointing earlier. Okay, so I'll talk a little bit more about this. So if you remember the distributed snapshots algorithm, that was a form of checkpointing your state. Okay, checkpointing not only your state but the state of all of the messages that were in transit. So that is the kind of technique we are talking about. So there are many ways to do this. So if you the simplest way is each process checkpoints independently. Okay, and upon a failure you then work backwards to locate the more consistent cut and then restart from that point on. Obviously if there is a dependency between processes, you have to use a distributed snapshot rather than just a simple independent checkpoint. Okay. Now, if you are doing this independently without using an algorithm like distributed snapshot, you will have to make sure that any snapshots across the processes are consistent. And if not, you keep rolling back until you find one. Okay, so if you don't coordinate, then you may have to roll back to a older checkpoint and have to restart from that point on and then redo all of the computation. So it's better to do a good job while you're checkpointing rather than to check after the failure occurs. So this we have already covered, so I'm not going to go into a lot of details here. But instead, what I wanted to talk about was a complementary technique called message logging. Now, we already looked at checkpointing. It should be clear that it's an expensive process. Checkpointing up, let's say, application state means taking all of the memory contents and storing it on disk. So now if you have a large process, it could have state that memory state could be hundreds of megabytes or even a gigabyte. If you look at your Firefox browser or anything like that, memory state is going to be several hundred megabytes because it has a memory cache and so on. So every time you checkpoint, you're writing tens, if not hundreds of megabytes out to disk. Okay, that's a lot of data to write. So you can't do this very frequently. So if you do it infrequently, what that means is your application has to roll back to a previous checkpoint, so you have lost all of the data or the computation that were performed in between. So to ensure that you don't have to roll back all the way to the previous checkpoint, you can combine checkpointing with another technique called message logging. So So what happens in this technique is that you simply log all of the requests, okay, or all of the messages which could be thought in abstract as a request that you act on between checkpoints to stable storage. So what happens in that case is when you roll back to a previous checkpoint, you will look at this log and you will replay all of these requests and then quickly catch up, as opposed to waiting for all of these requests to be resent to you in order to catch up. Okay. So that's the basic idea. So you will keep a log of everything that has happened since the previous checkpoint. So then you roll back to the previous checkpoint and then just replay the log and then just catch up to wherever the application was before it crashed. So this avoids the need to throw away everything that has happened since the previous checkpoint because you keep a track of everything. So let's just take an example of a disk. Okay. This is, yes, your question.
Isn't this a technique like less general than the previous one, in the sense like this is only for applications which have some events or something?
Yes, like you're right. So in this case, it will only work when you have messages coming in or requests coming in. But I'm just going to claim that if you are a distributed application, you are going to send messages, right? So but let me give the example I wanted to give first. Okay, let's suppose you take this a disk as an example of something you want to make fault tolerant. So you have backups, right? So let's suppose you do daily backups. Okay, that's your checkpoint effectively, because the backup copies whatever your disk state is onto another medium. Okay, so now if there is a disk crash in between two backups, everything that happened since the previous backup is lost. Okay, all of the file modifications you have made since the previous backup is gone. Okay. If you combined checkpointing, in this case backups, with message logging, what would happen is you would keep a separate log of every modification that has been made since the previous checkpoint. So every write to the system is logged in a separate file. Okay. So now you would recover from the previous backup and you will replay the log saying, okay, this file was deleted, I wrote this block to this file, I did this modification to this file. You replay everything and then you are now back to where you were before the crash. Yeah. So this avoids the problem of having to throw away everything that happened since the previous checkpoint. You can actually recover to a state that is very close to where you were. Okay, your question.
The common case, so, I mean, because every time you do an operation, you have to log it.
Yes. So this does bring with it a disadvantage, which is you have to log, right? So, but I mean, you have to pay some price if you want fault tolerance. If you are not willing to pay that price, then you have to tolerate the loss, right? So fault tolerance always comes at some price. In this case, the log is a redundant set of operations. I mean, it's a redundant state that you have kept. In addition to the disk state, you know what happened. Okay, yes, your question there. Right. So, you know, you are asking a question, how does this work in a distributed scenario, right? So here I have not actually talked about what happens when you have a set of communicating processes, who replays what. Okay, so that's a different problem. So in that case, you have to have additional consistency to figure out. So when you do this, what you will do is each process will you just replay the log, but no outgoing messages will be sent, because it's assumed that either that process is already up and has executed it, or it also crashed and it's also playing its log out. Okay, so you're not going to do what everything that was done and resend out messages. You will just replay the output. Replay the input. So this is the same as in the disk case. If you had to delete a file, okay, and let's suppose that the operation didn't succeed because you did not have write access to the file. Okay, in the case when the delete was executed, the user would have seen a message saying invalid operation. Okay, but when you replay it from the log, you are going to get the same error, but you are not going to send that out. So you didn't send this output. You just execute all the operation and assume that all the output has already gone out. That's the assumption. Okay. Any other questions here? Okay, so I just in the disk case, I just want to mention that this notion of a log is not something I made up. Most of the modern file systems have a feature called journaling. Okay. Journaling is precisely this. It actually keeps track of all of the operations that were that have gone on the file. And journaling is not necessarily used to recover from a disk crash. It is used to make sure the file system doesn't get corrupt. Okay, so suppose that there is a power failure on your machine. The file system had some dirty blocks cached in its memory. Okay, all of those dirty blocks go away. They are never sent to disk. Okay, but if the file system maintains a log, it would have kept track of all of the operations that were performed on the file system. So when the system is rebooted, it will replay the log and recover this lost state. So in the case of journaling, so you have this to keep the file system consistent, but the same principle is true. You could have a disk log to make sure that you can recover from disk failures. Okay. Any other questions on logging? Okay. So I wanted to just mention briefly another approach. We will not talk about this in any great detail, but this was an approach that was advocated by the research community. It's called recovery-oriented computing. Okay? So this goes back to the question that you just raised, saying fault tolerance is expensive. Okay, you have to keep logs, so there's an overhead of logging and so on. So what this approach says is rather than spending a lot of overhead on preventing faults altogether, let us focus on how to efficiently recover from them, how to optimize the recovery, which is why it's called recovery-oriented computing. Okay. So a simple example of what this philosophy means is, let's take the naive case of a reboot. Okay. So in the OS kernel, if you think of a certain part of the kernel fails, the entire kernel crashes. Right. So your system fails and you have to reboot the whole thing. Okay. Now if you built your kernel in a more modular way, it is possible that the fault can be isolated to a certain component of that kernel. Okay? So you may have to restart or reload only that component rather than the whole kernel. So your system as a whole can continue to function while some parts of it will fail, okay, and have to be restarted. So it doesn't mean that you will somehow avoid the fault. All this says is some philosophy is failures are always going to be the norm. So how do we optimize the recovery process? So there has been work called micro reboots, where you have this very modular kernel, each is a different piece, and you can only reboot parts of it rather than the whole kernel. This is also true when you apply, like, let's say, software updates or patches that come out. Right? So there may be a security patch or an update. If it's applied to the kernel, you have to reboot the entire system. In most cases, the patch has only touched a part of the kernel rather than the whole thing. So it may be sufficient if you had written a modular system to only restart or reboot that component rather than the whole thing. Okay, so that's the basic idea here, is how do you design systems for recovery rather than to tolerate faults. So let's assume that faults are going to happen no matter what you do. So let's make the recovery part painless as opposed to putting a lot of effort into engineering a system that will prevent faults altogether. So there has been a lot of work on this topic. So there are people have been looking at how you can isolate driver failures. Lot of kernel crashes actually occur not because there's a bug in the kernel, but because there's a bug in a driver that someone else wrote that you did not write. So you put in some new hardware, you get someone else's driver, you put it in, that has bugs, that crashes, it brings the whole kernel down. Okay. So people have been looking at how do you isolate just driver faults so that only that driver, if it misbehaves, it is ejected from the kernel. So and the rest of the kernel continues to function rather than it just bringing down the whole kernel. So, so there are techniques like that that people have looked at. Now, this philosophy hasn't really been extended out into the distributed world. Okay, so we are really interested in failure recovery in distributed systems. So what recovery-oriented computing means in the distributed case is still not completely clear, because in a distributed case, we have been talking about failures of certain parts of the system that do not bring the whole system down. Okay, this is also the same philosophy. How do you isolate fault to small pieces and just recover those pieces? Okay, so there's still evolving research idea, but something that people are in the fault tolerance community are looking at in quite some detail. Okay. Any questions here? This is the last slide on fault tolerance, and then I'm going to start a new topic.
Does that mean microkernel can provide more
capability? Right. So, good question. The question is, well, can microkernel help with recovery-oriented computing? So, a lot of people who are looking at this are actually now looking at microkernel as an example. So if you, I don't know if you looked at this optional reading I had put up on the course webpage. Andy Tannenbaum had this nice article on why microkernels are a good idea. So this was when I had actually talked about monolithic kernels and microkernels. If you go back to that, you will see that some of the arguments he's made why microkernels are useful today is fault tolerance and security, right? So rather than one monolithic thing, you have lots of small pieces. So security only impacts a small part of the system, not the whole. Or if there are faults, they only impact parts of it. So there are people like him who advocate microkernel for precisely recovery-oriented computing type arguments. Okay. So next topic is on security. Okay, this is chapter 9. So today I'm going to do an introduction and maybe delve a little bit into this topic. I will not go into a whole lot of depth here because this is a topic that actually predates a course that is now offered in the department. And you could actually, just as there's a grad course on computer networks, there's also a grad course on computer security. So some of these topics I have started de-emphasizing here, but we will learn enough about enough background here to understand what security means for our context, which is distributed system. But I'm not going to go into a whole lot of details, okay, into cryptography and so on, but just give some quick background. Okay, so what's the basic problem that we are trying to address in security? So we'll look at network security because that's what is important in the context of a distributed system. So the assumption is there are two or more processes or entities, let's just call them entities. In security world, this is Alice and Bob, okay, A and B. It's Alice and Bob. And they are communicating over some channel, okay? And they are sending messages. So what we want is to ensure certain properties that will hold on this communication. So an assumption is there can be an intruder who can listen on all of the messages that go back and forth, okay? So the intruder may eavesdrop on the messages, okay? Can remove, modify, or insert messages into this channel, read and play back messages. Okay? So intruder is allowed to do any of these things. Okay? So if you look at what this means from a security threat standpoint, this means that the threats you are trying to address in the context of this communications interception, which is eavesdropping, interruption, which is you remove a message. You send a message, it never gets to the other end. Modification, which is I either modify a message that Alice or Bob have sent, or I insert messages that were never sent. And so that's, and then fabrication, which is the creating fake messages or replaying messages. So these are the threats we want, or that's the threat model, as is sort of alluded to. So what are the techniques that are used to address these? Okay, so there is or encryption or cryptography, authentication, authorization, and auditing. Okay? So encryption basically is the problem of ensuring secrecy of any information that's transmitted. Okay, you send a message, okay, if you send it encrypted, then that message cannot be read by anyone other than the destination or the recipient. Okay, that's what is encryption. Authentication is the problem of proving who you are to the system. Okay? Or clear. So if you claim to be someone, you need to prove that you are that entity or that person. Okay? Authorization is the problem of verifying that you have the rights to perform certain action. Okay, so if you want to change a password, the system has to ensure that you are allowed to change that password, which is why it asks you for your old password. So then prove that you are the person who you claim to be, and once you prove that you are that person, then you are allowed to change the password. Just one example of authorization. Okay? And auditing is the problem of logging everything that the system is doing for post-facto analysis. Okay? So this does not prevent any security attack, but it keeps track of everything that has gone on, so you can go back later and figure out what happened. Okay? How did the system get hacked? Okay? Where did this virus come from? So you want to understand that, you have to keep track of what happened in the system. Okay? That's what is called auditing. So we'll look at some of these issues in a little more detail, starting with the starting with encryption. Okay? So the simplest way to understand this is to start with an application that does not use any encryption. Okay? So Telnet is an example of a remote login application that did not use any security. Okay? So in this case, Alice was you and Bob was your computer. And you are trying to log in into your machine from a remote endpoint or a remote machine. Okay? So you telnet to your machine. Okay? So you say telnet, and then it brings up a login prompt and asks you for your username. Specify the username, and it prompts you for the password. Okay? Now it so happens that all of these messages are going back and forth unencrypted, plain text. Okay? So if any intruder were to listen on this, okay, and if in particular if that intruder could intercept your username and the packet that contained your username and packet that contained the password, these are just unencrypted strings. Okay? So now your password and username have been revealed. So clearly this doesn't work. So you need to do better if you want to ensure the secrecy of your password. Okay? Now this is a simple example, but there are many other scenarios where this is still a problem. Okay, so mail spoofs is an example. The reason you get a lot of spam is because there is no encryption or authentication. Okay, so someone can masquerade as some other person and start sending messages. The mail server doesn't check whether you are even authorized to use that mail server to send spam. Okay, so there are all these network management messages that you could send and cause problems. So routers, when they exchange routing information, they do not encrypt those messages. Okay, neither do they perform authentication. So you could send a fake routing update to a router claiming to be some other router, and that router is going to accept that message. Okay, so you could just partition the network by sending fake routing updates. So there are all sorts of problems that can crop up, and although some of these protocols have security features, so these days you use SSH, not Telnet, for example, many others still don't. Okay, so, but that's not a good way to design system, just as you have to think about fault tolerance. Security is another of those topics that is often ignored when you design your system, and then later on you think what to do, okay, how to make it secure. So these are things that one should consider while designing the system, not as an afterthought. Okay. And users need to play a more active role as well. I mean, it's not, so you could use SSH, but if you have a bad password, nothing is going to prevent someone else from guessing it and logging in. Right? So it's not just the system, but the user as well. Okay. So I'll start with an encryption today. I'm going to give a quick overview of a few encryption algorithms. And then next time what I will do is try to explain how some of these techniques can be used for higher level applications that are of more interest to us. For example, electronic payments, electronic transactions, how can you do this in a secure fashion? If you want to send encrypted email, how would you use all of these ideas to build these systems? Okay, that's so. But you need some background, so I'm going to quickly review some encryption material. Okay? So the terminology we are going to use in the context of encryption is something, if you have a message that is unencrypted, we'll call it plain text. In the encrypted form of the message, we'll call it ciphertext. Okay? Now in any encryption algorithm, the intruder can intercept messages. Okay, that's this part where the intruder is just listening on the network and just intercepting messages. Okay, can intercept plain text, ciphertext pairs. Okay, and figure out what the encryption algorithm is, or he or she can even figure out what encryption algorithm you are using. Okay, and you want to have secure communication, or you want to ensure secrecy of your communication, even if the intruder could figure out all of this. Okay, so that's the problem of finding a good encryption algorithm. Okay, so this is the very simple encryption algorithm. This is called as substitution cipher. So for every alphabet of your message, okay, here we are using English, but if you are using, let's say, some other form of communication, sending binary messages, you have to do something similar. For every letter, you have a substitution. Okay, so this is your cipher. And then when you want to send a message, you look up this mapping, and then you substitute that letter for every letter of that message. And then you send your ciphertext. Okay? So here in this case, this is the ciphertext for this message. Very simple encryption algorithm. Okay? So also called symmetric key cryptography, because the receiver has to use the same key, has to know the same mapping in order to decipher the message. Okay? And this has 26 factorial keys. So if you actually look at all possible mapping, there are 26 factorial of them, which is not small, but not huge either, but no, but not trivial. Okay? But even though there are 26 factorial keys, this substitution cipher that I just described is very easy to decipher. And this is because you can use certain properties of the English language. Okay? So for example, if you know that E is the most common letter that occurs in text, the is the most common word, you can just analyze the message. Okay, and then in this ciphertext, for example, you can see what's the most frequent letter that occurs. And with some high probability, that may be an E. Okay, so if you now partly break the cipher, and if you know English, then you can basically do dictionary lookups to figure out what could this word be. Okay, because you know some letters of the word, but not the whole word. And that allows you to then further decipher what the key is, and then at the end you have gotten the key. Okay, so this is how you hack into encryption algorithm. So clearly you need to do better. So I'm going to talk about two classes of algorithm: symmetric key encryption. Yeah, an example of this would be DES. Okay, not used widely anymore, but I'll still talk about how this works. And then in asymmetric key encryption algorithms, an example I'm going to use is RSA, or public key cryptography. Okay. So just to understand DES, so this is the DES stands for data encryption standard. Okay. This is an encryption and decryption algorithm that is published, and it's a known standard. So the algorithm used to encrypt and decrypt is well known. So if I show you a DES encrypted message, you know precisely what algorithm was used to encrypt it. Okay. So even the intruder knows. Is the implication. Okay. Now this use 64-bit keys, okay, which is why it is no longer secure, because it's vulnerable to brute force attacks. So you can just try out all combinations and figure out what the key is. Okay, so I'll show you how it works. So there are 19 stages of transformations involving 16 of which involve the keys. Okay. Now because the key size is small, which as the computation power that's available to hackers increases, you have to ensure that the key you use in your encryption algorithm is larger and larger, because otherwise you are vulnerable to brute force attacks, okay, where you just try all possible combinations of the key, and 64-bit keys are no longer secure, which is why this algorithm was replaced by something called triple DES, or DES 3, or actually it should be 3 DES, not DES 3. So what triple DES does was it used 3 keys rather than 1. So you have 3 different keys, but it used the same algorithm. Okay? Now even that is not secure, so it's now been replaced by something called Advanced Encryption Standard, or AES, which uses 128-bit keys. I'm not going to talk about AES, but just want to mention that although we are talking about this, this is just as example encryption algorithm, but not widely used anymore, especially if you want to keep things secure. So this is how it works. So at the very top, you have a 64-bit string chunk, and you want to encrypt it, and this is the output. Okay? So if you have any message, you will chop it up into 64-bit chunk, and you will encrypt each one, and then you send the message. And then at the decryption, you do the same thing. So you use a key here, okay? And so this key is what is being used to encrypt the message. The reason the algorithm is secure is that the key is supposed to be secret. Okay, the algorithm is known, but if somebody doesn't know what the key is, they don't know how to decrypt your message. Okay? So you use this key and you generate 16 keys, and so there are 16 rounds. So within each round, you will use one of these keys, you will use that 64-bit chunk, and you will encrypt it with that key, get the next stage, you do that until you get the output. Okay? Each of these stages looks like this. Okay? So this is your 64-bit string. You have a left half and the right half. Okay, the right half, just for the next stage, you just take the right half and it becomes the left half of the next stage. And the right half is basically you take the left 32 bits, the right 32 bits, and then you do this operation. Okay, so you encrypt the right with the key. Okay, this is the encryption. And then you XOR it with the left, and that gives you the right. Okay. Now, why this is done, we'll not go into. This is just the public, the published algorithm. But this is what is used. Okay. And this slide shows how the different keys are generated. Okay, because you have to generate 16 of these. So you do a permutation, you get 28 bits. Okay, then you do a left rotate, extract 24 bits from there, extract 24 bits, and that gives you one key. And you repeat this, you get 16 different keys from a single 56-bit key, one for each round. Okay, and so you basically, so this operation is now done at each of these rounds, and you get the final result. Okay. So that's how this encryption algorithm works. Okay. Now this reason this is called symmetric is that you use the same algorithm to decrypt, meaning that you will take, if you take this output and you feed it in the input and you use the same key, what comes out is the original input. Okay. So this is why it's called symmetric. Okay. So now the problem that is very important in any encryption algorithm is how does the receiving end know what key you have used? Yeah, because to decrypt it, they need to know the key. So this problem is referred to as key distribution. Okay? And in case of symmetric keys, the two endpoints have to agree on the key before they can start communicating. Okay? So you need a mechanism to distribute keys. Okay? So how this is done is very important. Okay? It has significant implications on the encryption algorithm itself. So if you can use a very secure encryption algorithm, but if you don't use a secure way of exchanging keys, then you are going to be vulnerable to attacks because someone else can intercept the key and then decrypt your message. Okay, so any encryption algorithm is only as secure as the key distribution mechanism used. Okay, so that's a very important thing to keep in mind. So the way this is typically done is you use a trusted agent. And we'll come back to this problem of key distribution next time. So if A and B want to communicate, they can go to the trusted agent and say, give us a key. Okay, the trusted agent is the reason we call this trusted agent is all entities that are part of this communication trusted. Okay. So the trusted agent then provides this key in over a secure channel, and then A and B can communicate. Okay. How this is done in detail will come to next time. Okay, but this is something that's very important. Keep this in mind. So next thing I'm going to talk about is quick overview of asymmetric encryption algorithm. So in particular, we'll look at what's called public key cryptography. So here the encryption key and decryption key are different. Okay, in the previous case, you had a single key that could be used to encrypt or decrypt. Here you have a pair of keys, an encryption key and a decryption key. Okay. In particular, in public key cryptography, the one of these keys is made public. And so in particular, the encryption key is made public. So everyone knows what this key is. So if they want to send you a message, they need to get your encryption key, encrypt the message with that key and send it to you. The decryption key is also called the private key. It's only known to you. So only you can decrypt that message. Okay, and anyone else that gets the message cannot do anything with it. So that's the basic idea. Okay, I'll show how this works. Okay, this is just a picture that shows the same thing. Let me just talk about a particular form of public key cryptography, which is RSA. Okay. This is still used, very popular standard for public key cryptography. So this is the basic idea. Okay. So how does RSA work? So it's basically the way you first you have to generate your public and private keys. Okay. This process shows you how to generate the keys. So the way you do this, you pick two prime numbers, P and Q. And these have to be very large primes, okay? But otherwise it's again vulnerable to attack. So then you compute the product of these two prime numbers, and we'll call that N. Okay? N is P times Q. We'll also compute the product of P minus 1 and Q minus 1. We'll call that Z. And now you have to choose another number D, which is relatively prime with Z, okay, meaning that D and Z, the D that you choose, should not have any common factors with Z. Okay. So basically, what that means is E times D equals 1 mod Z, or basically that's what you get here. E times D is K times P minus 1, Q minus 1 plus 1. Okay. I'll show an example of how all this works in just one moment. Okay, now once you've gotten these three numbers, E and N are made public. This is the encryption key, and D is the decryption key, which is kept secret. Okay, so this is the basic idea. I'll show you an example of how all this works in just one moment. But let me, given the encryption key, let me show you what you do to encrypt. So you take a bit string, an arbitrary string, then you do that best number. So if you think of that bit string as an integer, take that integer to the power e mod n. Okay? That is your encrypted string. Okay? And to decrypt, you do the same thing. You take the encrypted string and then you do that to the power the decryption key that gives you back the original. Okay? And I'll show why this is true in just a moment. Okay? Now there are some things to keep in mind. Why is this? Why does this work? Because factorizing very large numbers is a difficult problem. This is at the fundamental basis of RSA. Because you have chosen large prime and you are taking the product of this prime, n is a very large integer. And factorizing n to guess p and q is non-trivial problem. Okay, even if you try brute force method, there are no good algorithms known to do this. Okay, so first an example, and then I'll show you why RSA works the way it is. Okay, so let's see here, we just choose small integers just to make this simple. So we'll pick two primes, 3 and 11. Okay, so these are P and Q, and N is the product, so N is 33 in this case. Okay, Z, which is P minus 1, Q minus 1, is 2 times 10, which is 20. Okay, so now you have to choose a number that is relatively prime to 20, so we choose 7. Okay, 7 and 20 have no common factors. So your decryption key is 7. Okay, in this case, encryption key is 3, because the encryption key is chosen such that E times D is this. Okay, so K equals 1, so E times D is 21. Okay, so since decryption is 7, the E becomes 3. Okay, so that's basically your encryption key. Okay, and 7 is your decryption key. N is 33. Okay, so now if you want to encrypt any number, you have to basically do this. Okay, so this is your message to the power E mod N. Okay. N is, in this example, 33. Mod 33, encryption key is 3. Okay. Take any message, okay, take a bit string that's an integer. So you do that to the power 3 mod 33. That's your that's an encrypted version of that string. Okay. And to decrypt it, you just do the DAC to the power 7 and you get back the original. Okay. Now, question is, why do you get back the original? So there's a number theory result that tells us why this works. Okay. In other words, what we want to show is if this to the power E to the power D mod N gives you back B. So if you, this is the encrypted message, and then you do the power D and you do mod N, you should get back the original. So why is this the case? Okay. So the number theory result that is at the basis of this is B to the power P minus 1, Q minus 1 mod PQ equals 1. Okay. Now I will not prove this result. This is known result. This is at the basis of why you get this property. Okay. So now you take B to the power E to the power D. Okay, that is B to the power ED. Okay. So since ED, if you remember the way we chose this, ED is this quantity. Okay. So you basically substitute this here. Okay. So you have B to the power K times P minus 1, Q minus 1 plus 1. If you just expand this out, you have B to the power P minus 1, Q minus 1, and you do this K times. Okay. But based on this result, B to the power P minus 1, Q minus 1, mod PQ, so all of this is mod N, which I just left out here. So each of this quantity here, based on that result, is 1. Okay, so you basically, each of this becomes 1, so it's B times 1 times 1 K times, which gives you back B. Okay. So that shows that the way we chose the encryption key and the decryption key. If you just do any string to the power, the encryption key, and then you raise that back to the decryption key, you should get back the original string. Okay? So this is the number theory result that's at the heart of RSA. Any questions here? Okay. So now what I'll do is show you a couple of ways to break how RSA can be broken. So suppose RSA itself is a good algorithm. You know, the problem is how you choose your encryption key, decryption key, or how do you encrypt the string itself. Okay. So now suppose the intruder had a table, say, which said for every string I compute the encrypted value. Okay. Since the public key is well known, okay, suppose I publish my public key. Okay, so then the intruder can keep a table which says for every string, what is the encrypted value of the string. Okay, so suppose the bit strings that you use are, let's say, 4 bit, just as an example. Okay, so there can be only 16 different strings that you can encrypt. Okay, so if you give any large string, I'll chop it into 4 bit strings and I encrypt each in turn. Okay, so the intruder just has to maintain a table of 16 values. So for 0000, what's the encrypted string? For 0001, what's the encrypted string? Because I know the public key, so I can encrypt each of these and get the encrypted value. Okay, so now I have this. So there's a message going on the wire. Okay, so I can just take the entire message, chop it up into 4-bit strings, do reverse lookup. Okay, so the first string I see is 0011. I do this table lookup and I see the right column and say, what is the original string for whose encrypted is 0001? And then I basically just substitute it and I get back the original message. Okay. So I have basically broken RSA. Is this clear what I just said? Now why is this true? Why is this happening? Okay. So although RSA is good, the problem here is you chose very small strings to encrypt. Okay. So in other words, I could basically construct a brute force table that says for every possible string you can send, I know the encrypted value. So I'm just doing string matches and I'm getting back the original message. So this basically says that B has to be large. Okay, so that this table is never feasible to compute this table. Meaning that the table is so large because the number of entries in the table is so large that you cannot do. So if I chose B instead of 4-bit strings, I chose, let's say, 1024-bit strings. So this table has 2 to the power 1024 entries. Okay, now the table is large. So if I have to compute for every possible bit value, 0001 all the way to 111 for 124 bit string, that's a large table. Okay, if I use 2048, that this is 2 to the power 2048 entries in the table. So if you choose B large enough, okay, then you cannot really compute this table ahead of time and keep this and then intercept messages and do reverse lookup on this table. So what this is pointing out is, although you know RSA to be a good algorithm, if you don't use RSA properly by choosing a good value of B, it is still vulnerable. Okay? Is that clear? Okay. Here's another technique that can also allow you to break RSA. So this is called man in the middle attack. Okay? So this is problem of key distribution. Okay, so now if I want to send, Alice wants to send a message to Bob, the first thing Alice has to do is get Bob's public key. Okay, if I don't know the public key, then I cannot send message. Okay, so if I do not have a good way of getting this public key, we get into trouble. And that's what this thing illustrates. So here, before you send an encrypted message, you ask for the public key. So in this case, here is Bob wanting the public key. So basically, it tries to get the public key, and there's an intruder in between. Okay? So the intruder actually intercepts this message, which is how to get the public key, and just returns a bad public key. In this case, you actually return your public key, not the other end's public key. Okay? So Alice, okay, wants Bob's public key, but ended up with the intruder's public key, thinking that is Bob's public key. So now you are encrypting every message with the encryptor's, the intruder's public key. So the intruder gets this message, decrypts it, okay, then re-encrypts it with the real public key and just sends it. Okay. So every message is decrypted and re-encrypted in transit. Okay? As far as Alice and Bob are concerned, they don't know this is happening. Because the encrypted message is going in, it's coming out. A different one is coming out at the other end, but the Bob thinks the message came from Alice. Okay? And now you are in trouble because every message is getting decrypted because a bad public key was used. Okay? So this says key distribution is an important issue. Okay? So if you are not able to distribute your public key in a good way, then you are in trouble. Now many people put up their public key on their web page. Okay? So suppose hacked into your web server and replaced that public key with some other public key. So somebody says, oh, I want to communicate with Alice. I'm going to go to Alice's web page, and she has published her public key on the web page because it's supposed to be well known. So why not just put it up on your web page? So you get that public key and you send a message. But if somebody hacked into your web server and replaced that web page and put a different value there, you are now using someone else's public key. If that person intercepts your message, they can decrypt. Okay? So you need to trust the public key you get and ensure that is really the public key that you need to use. Okay? And we'll see ways you actually can verify that this is someone's public key and not just have to take that for granted. Okay? So we'll see how you use certification authorities and so on. That someone else certifies that this is Alice's public key. So if you trust that certification authority, you know that is Alice's public, not just some public key that is published. Okay? Any questions here? So before I end, I just wanted to show that although you may have used all of this, you probably don't know some of the inner working. So people use this in email, for example. So here is a tool, and this is just a repository of all public keys. So here is mine. So this is my public key. Which this is not visible here. Okay, so this is my public key, and here. So let me show you a certificate. Oh, here is. Okay. So this certificate. So this is something that embeds a public key. And this does it say public key? Look at something else, just hold on. Okay, so here is one. It's a public key somewhere. Okay, it does say public key. So you'll see that this is public key, it says use RSA. This is the size of the public key, it's 2048 bits, so it's a long key. And then the key itself is embedded in here. Okay. So if you send email, you can send your public key in that email, and then this tool just extracts it and stores it. Your private key is only supposed to be known to you, right? So the public key has come, but the private key is only known. So if I use this public key and I encrypt any message with that public key, only the person whose public key this belongs to can decrypt it. Okay, but your private key you're supposed to store securely. So here is mine, which you're not supposed to give out to anyone, because if somebody gets a private key, you are in trouble. Okay. So you can also revoke keys that you are known to be lost or compromised, which people do frequently. Okay. So SSH also uses this. Okay, so I'm going to show you quickly. So if you actually use SSH and you generated a key, it's stored in your .ssh directory. So there are two files that get created, a public key and a private key. Okay. So now this is not your key, it's your machine's key. Okay. So in this case, this is the public key of my machine. So this is the key. Okay. And the private key, so the public key you can now put on any other machine. Okay. So now if you want to set up a connection, the public key is there. You can set up a secure connection. And only you are supposed to know your private key. So here is, so this is your RSA private key, and this only your machine knows. Yeah, so you can give out your machine can give out its public key, and any other machine can securely communicate. Okay, we'll see how SSH works next time using this concept. Okay. So if you actually dig in, you'll see that you are probably using this in some shape or form already. If you do email and so on. Okay, so let me go back to the slide here. So that's RSA. So having covered encryption, next time I want to actually talk about application. Okay, so we'll talk about remote logins, we'll talk about secure email, we'll talk about electronic payments. Okay, how do you use encryption to make electronic payments or electronic cash that you can just use over internet and so on. So these are the kinds of things we are interested in the context of distributed systems. So that's just had to provide some background before we get into all of this. Okay. So I think that is probably all I have for today. So we are going to end a little early. Okay. And then next time we'll start looking at some of the applications using encryption and so on. Okay. Yes.